It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Let's start out with local, as we always do, and medical marijuana making the news.
Yes, after Governor Gregoire vetoed the legislature's bill to regulate medical marijuana dispensaries, the Seattle City Council decided they would take matters into their own hands. And this week, ordinance introduced by Nick Licata passed through the Housing, Human Services, Health, and Culture Committee. It was passed unanimously. And it's going to go to the full council for a vote on Monday. But what the ordinance would do is it would require medical marijuana dispensaries to get business licenses in the city of Seattle to pay taxes and to meet city land use codes. They would also have to abide by the chronic nuisance property law, which is essentially to what clubs have to do. They can't have too many complaints about their business in a neighborhood, or the city might come in and shut them down.
Well, didn't they already have to do all those things?
Well, no, not necessarily. This formalizes it, because the city really can't enforce unless you have the law on the books. So this kind of formalizes, makes it so that medical marijuana dispensaries, people who run them, know what the rules are and can operate at least somewhat legally in the city of Seattle.
Yeah, the main thing I think that this does is that it puts the city's stamp on the idea that, yes, these are legitimate businesses. These are legitimate enterprises. And because with the Gregoire vetoing some but not all of the reform bill, there's a lot of ambiguity. There's even more ambiguity now in this state law around regulating medical marijuana than there was before, and it's really unclear how it's going to be enforced by law enforcement and by prosecutors around the state. And so this is the city council's attempt to bring some clarity to that and say this is what the will of the legislative arm of the city wants to do.
Yeah, and here's what a law regulating these businesses should look like. And it's a way to try to poke the legislature and the governor to do something during the next session.
And I assume they have to abide by the law that they have to smoke 25 feet away from the entrance?
No, actually, as part of the law, they can't openly display or use marijuana on the premises. So, no sampling, for example.
But again, that was already illegal.
That was already illegal, yeah.
Okay. Moving on, a big turnout for the King County hearing on Metro.
Yeah, there was a big crowd that turned out at the King County Council chambers for a meeting.
All of whom drove there.
Not necessarily. To oppose cuts in spending on Metro bus services. People evidently lined up around the block, and they had two additional rooms to hold the overflow crowd. Over 360 some people signed up to testify. But interestingly enough, there were only 4 of the 9 King County Council members who showed up for that meeting. Yes, it was a Transportation Committee meeting, but only Democrats Bob Ferguson, Larry Gossett, Joe McDermott, and Larry Phillips showed up. And some of the committee members, some of the actual members of the Transportation Committee, flaked out, most particularly the committee vice chair, Pete Von Reichbauer, a Republican who has said that he won't vote for the $20 tab to provide funding to plug Metro's budget hole. And Jane Haig, who is also a member of that committee and won't support the fee, she didn't show up either. And noticeably absent was fence-sitter Democrat Julia Patterson, who represents South King County, where a lot of folks who are impoverished and need to use the Metro Transit services live. She's not on the committee, but she has more reason than just about any of the other members of the county council to be there. When you don't know, when you can't make up your mind how to vote on a topic, you need to listen to the public to have them tell you how you should vote.
And hasn't she said something clueless like, my constituents don't care about this or don't use Metro or something like that?
She has said that. Yes, and she is completely in the wrong there. So Julia Patterson, I think folks ought to take the meeting to her. Find out where she's going to be in the next week and, you know, go and testify. You know, you don't necessarily have to talk about the topic at hand. If you want to go and take signs and show up and say, Patterson, get on the bus, then then do that, I think. Also, I should point out, too, that at least one of the county council members who was at that meeting, Council Member Gossett, he isn't on the Transportation Committee, but he managed to show up anyway, so there's no excuse for people like Patterson to have flaked out.
All right. Moving on. Bellingham. Making news by banning plastic bags.
Yeah, the city of Bellingham this week voted to ban plastic bags. They're the second city in western Washington after the city of Edmonds passed an ordinance to ban plastic bags. The law passed unanimously by the Bellingham City Council, and it puts a 5-cent fee on it bans plastic bags outright and puts a 5-cent fee on all paper bags. The money doesn't go to the Bellingham city government. The money stays with the retailers to help them cover their costs for buying the more expensive paper bags, because plastic bags are generally cheaper. Also, the Portland City Council, Portland, Oregon City Council, is also considering right now a plastic bag ban. So Seattle's got no excuse.
Well, to be fair, when Seattle moved to do this, it was the American Chemistry Council or whatever their name was, this association, the lobbyists that basically forced that issue onto the ballot. Seattle did, in fact, try to do this.
Yeah, the Seattle ordinance, though, was very, very different from the one
that
passed.
Yes, it was, and not nearly as stringent.
Yeah, the Seattle ordinance would have put a 20-cent fee on all disposable bags, like plastic bags and paper bags, and then would have collected that fee, a portion of that fee for would have been remitted to the government. It would to the government of the city, and then the city would have had this whole enforcement program, et cetera, et cetera. And I think a large part of that is what people objected to. Bellingham.
Well, it was portrayed as a tax in the campaign against.
Yeah, and Bellingham didn't do that. They basically said paper's better than plastic, so we're going to ban plastic. And we're going to let retailers charge a little bit of money for these paper bags. That's a very simple ordinance, and there was no conflict at all over passing it in Bellingham. So that's a model for the city of Seattle, essentially. If you're going to do it right.
All right. Moving on, Mayor Mike McGinn having some disagreements with Village Voice.
Yeah, this has been in the news quite a bit this week. Mike McGinn taking on Village Voice Media over
which owns the Seattle Weekly.
Yes, which owns the Seattle Weekly over juvenile prostitution. The Village Voice Media manages a website for classified advertisers called Backpage.com. Turns out that the escort ads on Backpage.com have been linked to 22 cases of juvenile prostitution in the city of Seattle just this year. And the reason that that's true is that to place an ad on Backpages.com, all you have to do is enter a credit card number and then just click on a box that says, yes, I am over the age of 18.
Whereas the stranger, for example, checks ID.
Yeah, the stranger requires you to come in and show a photo ID to prove that you're over age 18 before you can place an escort ad. McGinn decided, well, we're going to withdraw all city advertising, which totals about $100,000 from the Seattle Weekly, which, again, is owned by Village Voice Media. He asked Village Voice Media to change their website so that it would do something similar to what the stranger does. And Village Voice Media came back this week and said, oh, you know, we're not going to change right away. We'll think about it and get back to you in a couple of weeks. Of course, you have to ask, what is there to think about? You know, I mean, are you guys gonna go back to your office and debate the virtues of juvenile prostitution? You know,
I don't think there's really much debate within the corporate hierarchy. Certainly, at Village Voice Media and Seattle Weekly, they're all pretty much pro.
Yeah. So it really kind of shows you what their corporate culture is.
And I should just say out of disclosure that I left Seattle Weekly in 2006, not too long after it was bought by the current ownership of Village Voice Media, which brought in their own people to run the Seattle Weekly, which changed quite a bit as a result of that turnover, and a lot of us who had been at the paper left, and the news section was decimated, and it really took on this sort of an appeal to the frat boy mentality, and that's where it is now, and that's how it's run now. Village Voice Media, which is the largest owner of so-called alternative papers, and I I say so-called because it's not really clear what they're an alternative to at this point. They're certainly not the.
They seem the so certainly, mainstream.
Certainly,
that,
certainly not the, you know, the progressive counterweight to mainstream daily papers that they were when they were founded. Although the Weekly has always been a little bit of an outlier in that respect and from the David Brewster days. But you know, the Village Voice media folks are basically libertarian in political outlook. And, really have very, you know, they drop their endorsements of political candidates. They don't feel any particular obligation to cover or not cover any political events. They've always been behind the stranger in terms of a lot of their cultural coverage. But this is the niche that they found themselves is being sort of a, you know, the frat boy paper in town. And, you know, to the extent that the stranger doesn't already cover that. And, you know, if you had to pick a paper for whom this would be a controversy in Seattle, that's who it would have been.
Yeah. And, McGinn basically said, look, you know, we've done the Seattle Police Department has investigated the escort advertisements in a bunch of different publications, including The Stranger. And the only one that they found problems with is Backpages.com run by Village Voice Media. And it's because that they don't adhere to the law. They're not checking to make sure that the people who place the ads are over age 18. And so I think what the city should do is they should sue Village Voice Media for aiding and abetting illegal activity. I mean, if you found somebody looking at child pornography on the internet, that person would go to prison. They'd go to jail. There's no excuse that the city should go after these guys.
All right. Moving on, update on the initiatives.
Yeah, the three initiatives that we talked about last week that look like they're going to qualify for the ballot, all of them have raised over $1 million each. And I bet you can't guess, or maybe you can guess, which one has raised
and
nearly $2 million.
You might list what the initiatives are.
Oh, I will. Yeah. I will. The first initiative I want to talk about is I-1183, the liquor privatization initiative. That one has raised almost $2 million, most of it from Costco. I-1125, the Tim Iman initiative for flat rate tolling and spending tolls only on the projects where they're collected, that one has raised $1.3 million with about $1.1 million coming from Kemper Freeman Jr. And you may remember last week we talked about how this is being billed as a no new taxes kind of initiative or a limiting government kind of initiative, when in fact the real impetus behind this initiative is to try to keep light rail from the east side, because by forcing the government to collect tolls and spend them only on the project where they're collected, that essentially will forbid them from spending the money on light rail expansion. I-1163,
which is, you know, Kemper Freeman's holy grail.
Yeah. I-1163, the home healthcare workers initiative, the one that would require home healthcare workers to get more training and to go through background checks. The SEIU has pretty much contributed the bulk of the money to that initiative, and it's raised so far about $1.38 million. So it looks like we're going to have yet another season where so-called citizen initiatives are going to be heavily advertised, at least for the folks who managed to pay the signature gatherers to collect enough signatures to get them on the ballot.
And not only that, but I mean, it's fair pointing out that in every one of those cases, the bulk of the money is coming from a single source. You know,
yeah.
It's not, you know, a mass of citizens petitioning for redress from a legislature that won't do what they want. It's single individuals or single companies trying to get voters to do what the they haven't been able to buy off legislators to do.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on, updates this week on issues related to radiation and nuclear facilities.
Yes, Heart of America Northwest, a local group in town who keeps track of goings-on at Hanford. They released a report this week discussing the radiation levels in the Northwest after Fukushima and the EPA's testing of those radiation levels. Well, it turns out that the EPA didn't test drinking water in Western Washington until March 25th. If you'll recall, the disaster happened in early March. And
the 11th, so 2 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah, and within about 5 to 7 days, the radiation would have reached the west coast of the United States. And, you know, if you take 11...
So it was a lag of at least a week.
Yeah, so if you take 11 and you add 7, that's March 18th. Well, nope, that's not when the EPA tested. They didn't test until March 25th, after you would expect radiation levels to have gone down somewhat. But what they found, even when they tested late, is that radioactive iodine-131 here in Western Washington was 53 times the EPA-mandated safety level for drinking water standards. The highest levels collected elsewhere on the West Coast were on March 22nd, earlier in the month, which sort of points to the fact that the EPA should have been in there testing almost immediately after the Fukushima accident, and they weren't. The highest levels of radioactive iodine and two types of cesium were found in Boise. That should have triggered a warning to the EPA that they should have been testing Washington and Oregon, but they didn't do that. They only did their routine once-a-month tests on the 22nd and the 25th.
And I don't remember that being highlighted in media coverage.
Oh, no.
Either.
In fact, they said in their press releases that, oh, we found some radiation, but levels are safe. They didn't say it's 53 times the EPA mandated safety levels. I want to also point out, too, that on March 31st, even though the EPA pointed out, oh, we're seeing mostly radioactive iodine, which has a half-life of 8 days, it'll disperse quickly, yada, yada. On March 31st, Jacksonville, Florida had tested with 50 times the safe level of radioactive iodine in their drinking water, which either puts the lie to the notion that radioactive iodine really has a half-life of 8 days, or more likely, the levels of radioactive iodine earlier in the month were much, much, much higher during that period when the EPA didn't test Western Washington and Oregon.
And
furthermore,
if it's that high in Jacksonville,
yes,
3,000 miles to the east.
Yes. You can imagine where else it might be high. And in addition, it took the EPA a week to publicly post the results of the tests that they did do. So even though they tested the water on March 25th, they didn't release the actual results of the test to the public until April 4th. So that lag time is unconscionable. When, if, for example, you're a mother with a young child and you want to know, is there some, you know, do I need to do something to protect my child? Should I buy bottled water? Should I get iodine tablets? What? And you can't even get the information from the EPA until a week after they do the tests. That's just terrible. And it points out the fact that the EPA, and one more thing. The EPA, not only did they not test during the time of the highest radiation levels, they didn't step up testing. So they made it sound in their press releases when they released the results that, oh, you know, levels are fine, we'll go back to our normal testing. They made it sound like they had been testing daily or that they had been testing regularly, when they didn't. They just did their regular once-a-month test. They didn't step up testing. They didn't respond to the Fukushima disaster at all. So that shows you exactly how much protection you're going to get from the EPA in this kind of a situation.
But we should all be relieved, because it's my understanding the EPA is out in the area now with their helicopter sampling the air regularly. Did you read that?
No.
Oh, they're crisscrossing different parts of Seattle, finding out what the
it's funny.
The new baseline is.
It's funny.
For future measurements.
I'm not seeing any... thing up in the air, no helicopters, no little.
Well, there's people who had reported seeing it this week. They're
really?
Wondering what,
you
the
know,
helicopter
what they
is.
Were.
Yeah, there are a lot of people over the years who've reported seeing government helicopters.
But this is actually
and we have medications for
there.
That kind of thing.
All right, let's move on. There was other news related to Hanford this week.
Yes, the U.S. Department of Energy has agreed to settle claims brought by about 139 people who claim that they got thyroid disease from exposure to radiation from Hanford. Each of the plaintiffs will only get about $5,683 after years of lawsuits.
Decades, actually.
Yeah, decades of lawsuits against the U.S. government for radiation contamination in the areas downwind from
decades
Hanford.
Decades of medical bills as well.
Yes.
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 And finally on local domestic terrorism.
Yeah, you know, you may have caught a little bit of this in the news. More likely, you didn't hear about it at all. It makes you wonder why the FBI is running after 18-year-old boys with fantasies of jihad when they could be doing something about the whoever it is who is who put 44 spikes into the railroad line near Bellingham, Washington, in an effort to derail trains. Now, the railroad system says that they're offering rewards of $5,000 for information concerning several, and I want to say that several, recent acts of vandalism that could have damaged railroad property or derailed trains along the rail lines near Bellingham. Well, interestingly enough, it doesn't seem as if any local law enforcement is doing anything about it. You know, and what I find very interesting is, okay, somebody out there is trying to attack infrastructure, but the FBI is nowhere to be seen.
But if we had videos suggesting that one of the people doing that was Muslim.
Yes, then there would be a major media circus, wouldn't there?
Yep, there would.
All right, let's move on then to national. A couple polls out this week.
Yeah, there's a Gallup poll that came out today, and of course people have been following the Kabuki theater that is the negotiation over the Congress extending the debt ceiling and Republicans refusing to move on that. And I don't want to get into all the ins and outs of that, but the basically the crisis is happening because the Tea Party Republican delegation in the House of Representatives is absolutely refusing to consider allowing the debt to be increased in the American debt, which will come due on August 2nd. Refusing to do that without tying it to dramatic reductions in the deficit, and doing that by cutting spending programs only. They're absolutely refusing to consider, as President Obama has been insisting, any kind of simultaneous revenue increases to try and reduce that deficit as well. Well, Gallup did a poll this week showing that only 20% of Americans, which is basically fewer people than believe Elvis is alive, agree with the Republicans on that. And furthermore, only 26% of Republicans want the federal deficit resolved only through cuts on spending. Another 26% or so want it resolved by mostly cuts, and then there's other mixes of cuts and revenue increases that account for most of the rest of it. But what this shows is that literally the entire, not just American economy, but the world economy in this standoff is being held hostage by people who are fundamentally out of touch and ideologically rigid, even compared with their own base, let alone the American public. It's really quite an alarming state of affairs.
Yeah. And there was another poll this week, too. The Quinnipiac University Polling Institute came out with a similar poll that said that 67% of Americans think that in a deal to raise the debt ceiling, that the government should raise taxes on the rich and corporations in addition to spending cuts in order to bring down the deficit. That's 67% think that you should raise taxes on the rich and corporations.
And to be clear, when Obama is talking about revenue increases, that's what he's talking about, is closing loopholes that are being enjoyed right now by the wealthy and the corporations.
By corporations, but also by wealthy members of the U.S. And in the same Quinnipiac poll, 71% of respondents said that, yes, they think the country is still in a recession. 54%, however, blame George W. Bush versus 27% who blame the Democrats and Obama, which proves that most Americans have a pretty good memory and know exactly who to look to for reasons behind why we're in the bad situation that we are. In addition, 62% of the respondents think that the government should try to bring down unemployment and that they should just forget about doing anything about the deficit for right now. That's not something you hear in the media these days, and certainly not something you hear from Republican politicians.
Or Democrats, for that matter.
Yeah, or the Democrats.
All right. Moving on, only about 5 minutes left. Clean coal.
Sorry. Yeah, a major utility back east based in Columbus, Ohio, called American Electric Power, killed a federally funded clean coal pilot program this week that the feds paid 50% of that would have pumped CO2 emissions underground. Now, that, mind you, is not a very effective way to to try and reduce carbon emissions. There really is no such thing as clean coal per se. But what it does tell you is it does tell you where corporate America is right now regarding climate change. The American Energy Electric Power's statement on why it wasn't willing to spend even the 50% that it was obligated to spend to continue the program was that it wasn't willing to spend the money, quote, in a political climate that has changed strikingly since the project began. What that means is that because legislation on climate change is dead, because Republicans control the House of Representatives, and because Americans have less concern over climate change now than they did 2 years ago, they don't feel particularly obligated or particularly pressured to do anything about it. And they would much rather spend the money instead in a way that they couldn't spend it 2 years ago, namely electing more people who deny climate change to office instead. Because of Citizens United, it's a more efficient use of their money to elect people who will make the laws that they make than to actually try to do something about climate change.
Yes, that's called spending on lobbying.
Yes, instead of spending on, you know, saving the planet.
All right. Rupert Murdoch making a lot of headlines this week.
Yeah,
anyway, he didn't want.
Yeah, the scandal which has been burbling under the surface in Britain for several years and has really exploded in the last few weeks in Britain around the tabloid news of the world and phone hacking of people who have been victims of crimes, and in particular one woman in Britain who a teenage girl who was kidnapped where a journalist.
She was kidnapped and she was murdered.
She was kidnapped.
And the journalist went in, listened to her voicemail, and they deleted messages so that the voicemail wouldn't fill up and that more messages could come in, which made police think that the girl was still alive when she
wasn't. And the parents as well.
And it destroyed valuable evidence.
Yeah. So that's been going on in Britain. But now the FBI has opened an investigation into whether similar practices were happening with Murdoch-owned newspapers, particularly the New York Post in the United States, around hacking the voicemail and the answering machine messages of 9/11 victims in 2001. So this is something that that's causing a lot of problems. News of the World has been shut down in Britain. A number of top executives of News Corp, Murdoch's company, have now been forced to resign, and it's threatening to spread to the News Corp empire in the United States as well.
Yeah, and you know, it kind of points out how these huge media conglomerations, these huge media monopolies operate. Murdoch has a conservative political agenda, and he's thrown his weight around by intimidating politicians in the UK to try to force even the most liberal Labour politicians to swing further right out of fear for what his papers might print about them. It really shows that companies like Murdoch's empire, these big media corporations, need to be broken up, and governments around the world should be breaking those monopolies.
And we've seen with things like, you know, the egregious misstatements on Fox News and Glenn Beck's program and so forth, where these companies will literally do and say anything in order to further their agenda. And their agenda primarily is to make money. It's only secondarily how they make money, by spreading propaganda and literally buying favors and buying politicians from government.
And forcing politicians to a conservative agenda that will help their bottom line.
Absolutely. And so it's a really very amoral universe. And finally, that amoral universe is catching up with them in a way that is very visceral and that a lot of people can just intuitively understand is wrong.
Yes.
All right. That leaves you all 30 seconds to talk about the CIA and vaccinations.
Yeah. Guardian UK report. Again, this was in British media this week, not American media. The CIA, in its effort to identify whether Osama bin Laden was in the compound in Pakistan, set up a fake hepatitis B vaccination program in kids in Abbottabad in order to try and get DNA samples from what they thought might be Osama bin Laden's kids in that compound. The problem problem was that when they set that up, they didn't return for the second and third vaccinations of the program. So a lot of kids in Abbottabad who think they're now protected against hepatitis B are not. And then when the word came out about the program, you've got what this does is make it difficult for any future vaccination programs to come in and make it suspicious that it's just a CIA or other covert program and isn't really meant to help people at all.
All right. Talking with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. That's where they find Eat the State. Local and national and international news and humor. And we may even have a commentary up on the Harry Potter movie. So we cover it all.